Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. It's a busy Tuesday. Wow. My name is Mark Shiver, and we will get you caught up, and everything's moving fast like a whirlwind around here and all over the state. Governor Pat McCrory apparently has officially filed for a recount. So has Auditor candidate Chuck Stuber. And so the plot thickens. It just keeps getting better and better by the day. So Governor Pat McCrory has formally requested a statewide recount in the gubernatorial race against Attorney General Roy Cooper. That was WRAL.com breaking that news, and apparently also auditor candidate Chuck Stuber. So my name is Mark Shiver. Like I said, glad to have you along, and we've got another big announcement. The Civitas Institute, Francis DeLuca, president of Civitas, will be joining us momentarily to talk about a complaint that has been filed on his behalf with the State Board of Elections and also a federal lawsuit. And we're going to clarify what that's all about. I've already seen on Twitter some incorrect tweets from some of the local media. Apparently they were not fully aware of what was going on, or maybe they are and just decided to mischaracterize. But basically it has to do with same-day voter registration. And once you listen to this segment with Francis, I think you'll understand that it all makes very perfect sense. So without any further ado, let's step aside here and we'll talk with Francis DeLuca from Civitas right now on What Matters in North Carolina. Well, as you know, there's a lot going on regarding voting and elections and voter fraud and counting and canvassing. And here to help us make sense of some of the latest is Francis DeLuca. He is the president of the Civitas Institute here in North Carolina. Francis, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Mark. Appreciate it.
And so this is a pretty significant day as regards all of this goings on regarding the election, as there's been an election protest and a lawsuit filed. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, and you know, more than passing interest in this, it was filed on behalf of me, and Civitas is sponsoring it. It is we have filed a protest with the State Board of Elections, and we filed a lawsuit with the Eastern District Federal, the court in the Eastern District of North Carolina Federal Court. And they're basically kind of similar, but a little different. What they concern is to stop the counting of same-day registrant voters until such time as those voters have their registrations verified. And what that means in plain English is they check to make sure that those voters are eligible to vote where they say they're want to vote. And this is the same practice they do with all voters. All we are saying is do what you say you will do to every voter who registers to vote. Right now there's over 6 million people registered in North Carolina, a lot more than 6 million.
Wow.
Well, the vast majority of those 6 million voters have had their votes, have had their registrations verified in the way that we want them to verify the same day registrants. Right now as it stands, same-day registrants, and those are people who go in during early voting, you know, at 17 days of early voting.
Right.
They register to vote, and they immediately vote in the election. Their ballots will be counted even if they don't pass the verification process. That is a fact.
Well, and it doesn't sound like logistically there's enough time to verify it.
Well, that's why we are filing a protest and filing a lawsuit to say you need to pull those votes out of the election stream. And once they have been verified, put them back in and count their ballots. That's all we're saying. Because we don't think we should have same-day registration. In fact, the legislature eliminated that in 2013. And the Fourth Circuit decided in their infinite wisdom to put it back in, even though they acknowledged the logistical problems with verifying the vote. They acknowledged that that's a problem.
Yeah, if you read their decision, they acknowledge there's a problem, and yet they left it in place. That doesn't make any sense.
And see, one of the reasons the legislature eliminated it was just what we are talking about in our lawsuit and in our protest to the Board of Elections, is that by leaving those in, people are voting who shouldn't be voting, and that really cancels out the vote of a legitimate voter. It cancels out someone who went through the process, who, you know, their vote, you know, it treats people differently. And that's the basic, it's a basic fairness question. If you and I have to do something, then these people should have to do something. It's not treating people differently. It's not putting any undue burden on them. It's just saying don't count their votes until they're verified. And this election, we filed it. We actually had planned on filing this about 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. We had problems finding a lawyer. We had, once we found lawyers, they had to do their work, and that's why it ended up getting filed yesterday.
So our guest Francis DeLuca talking about this lawsuit and action regarding same-day registration. Francis, it really sounds simple to me, and I want to make sure that I'm not missing something here. Basically, somebody goes in during early voting, they register and they vote at the same time, and that vote currently will count even though they might not pass muster when they go through the verification process. And so what this action is doing is saying, hold on, let's just pull those ballots out and make sure that these people are verified, just like I was when I registered to vote during the regular normal time.
Right. That you got it exactly. And if you wonder what we mean by verify, everybody, when you register to vote, gets a voting a voter registration card mailed to them.
Right.
That's the verification process. We're not talking about some big process or anything. We're just, you mail them a voter registration card. If it comes back within 15 days, you do another mailing. And they put that 15-day deadline on there for a reason. So if it doesn't come back after 15 days, you're registered. Even if it didn't get delivered, you're registered.
Okay.
So we're not talking about a process that is some never-ending process and involves jumping through hoops. It requires no other action on the part of the registrant other than that card doesn't come back to the Board of Elections. What ends up happening is that after the first mailing, if it comes back, they mail again. So you've got 15 days the first time, 15 days the second time, and assuming the Board of Elections do it as soon as someone registered, because that's what the law says, they're supposed to verify immediately after they register.
Okay.
So you're talking about a little over 30 days to get it done. Now, by practice, what ends up happening is the second one gets mailed. A lot of those come back long after the 15 days, but their votes get counted anyway. We're not telling them to hold it past the regular registration process. Just
right.
At least give the time that you say you want, regular people to go through.
Well, just treat everybody equally, fairly. I think that's
fairly. That's right.
A key word there. Now, the Board of Elections in May of 2015 had a report that is quoted in this action, and it says, and I think this just really is an excellent paragraph here. It says, an individual who registered and voted on the last day of same-day registration, the Saturday before Election Day, would not even begin the process of mail verification at the absolute earliest the following Monday. So there's no way that they could be verified by Election Day.
That's right.
Yeah. So logistically, it's just impossible.
The first ones in the same-day registration process, if they did, in voting, would have been about the 22nd, 23rd of October.
Okay.
The people who voted at the very beginning of early voting, theirs could have potentially been verified. That's assuming they had mailed them immediately. And, that did not... In the case of the 2008 and even the 2012 election, some of the verification mailings actually weren't made till like months after the election. So a number of people's votes were counted and found not to be legitimate voters long after the election was over.
Now, this is a real situation because in 2012, it says that 2,361 same-day registrants who failed the state's mail verification process were counted.
Yeah, they have to be. Their votes are counted because we were supposed to go through the county canvas last Friday. That's really your first step in making sure votes are counted. Once you've canvassed, the counties are kind of done in their thing. And then the state canvasses, and that's the second part of the process, and that occurs less than 30 days after voting.
Right.
So you're really talking about saying, okay, here's our real numbers, and you have even determined were these people real voters. And what the state by practice has done is that when a voter mail is returned a second time, they don't go back and pull that ballot out and redo the numbers. They just say, okay, well, this is now an inactive voter. They're still on the registration rolls, unlike somebody who that happened to during the regular process. In the regular process, if it comes back twice, you were considered that you never were registered.
Huh. How about that?
But if you get it back the second time for same name registration, they're considered registered, just inactive.
Just inactive. Well, there's a figure here of about, I think, 2.44% that this report found that same-day registration voters ultimately fail mail verification. And let's bring this practically forward, Francis. The fact of the matter is that that's probably not enough to overturn what's going on in the current governor's race. And so this really isn't about that, as some people might accuse.
Well, we would argue with that number. We did a study ourselves, and we came up with numbers that were much higher. Mm. But what they did establish is that people during same-day registration failed the verification process at a higher rate than people during regular registration periods.
Okay.
The state board validated that part of it, that the people who registered at the end. So it really doesn't matter if it's 1%, if it's 10%. When you allow people who shouldn't be voting to vote, it's potentially canceling out the vote of people who are legitimate voters.
Absolutely.
So I think that it's important not to let the percentages really guide what you're doing. We are doing this because it's the right thing to do. The policy should be we don't register people and not check their registrations and yet count their ballots.
Absolutely. Well, it's pretty simple, and it sounds pretty smart to me. Francis DeLuca, thank you very much for, let me ask you this. What do you expect? What happens next in the process of this action?
The process is there'll probably be a hearing. The court will either take it for a hearing or dismiss it, you know, without taking it for a hearing. The State Board of Elections, I think, they are probably going to be meeting a lot in the next few days.
I would imagine.
I think they'll take this up in due course of their meetings and determine if it's a legitimate complaint. Our lawyer will be there representing me in Civitas, so that's the next steps.
Great. Well, we'll certainly keep everyone informed going forward. Francis DeLuca, president of the Civitas Institute, thank you as always for being our guest here on What Matters in North Carolina. Well, Francis makes it all very understandable what's going on, and just to summarize, you know, there are same-day registrations that take place during early voting, and they have to be verified, just like you or I when we registered to vote. During, you know, no, like if you went today to register to vote, you would get a card in the mail. And if that card did not get sent back to the Board of Elections, they would assume that you are who you say you are, you live where you say you live, and your registration would be verified. Well, there's no time during same day registration at early voting to get that done, just logistically. You know, stuff has to be sent to the Board of Elections. They have to look at it. They have to mail the card. And so I think this is very practical what Civitas is doing. Let's make sure that these same-day registrations are, in fact, registrations that will be verified. And if they are, count them. And if they're not, just like anybody else, well, don't count them. Isn't that fair? I think so. So I think that's a very good job on the part of Civitas to be bringing this action, and I hope that the state board, you heard Francis say, they will consider it likely, and the federal court will decide whether or not to have a hearing on that. So we will keep you posted and up to date here on What Matters in North Carolina about all of that. Well, I saw some interesting news where the Program Evaluation Committee at the General Assembly met the other day, and they were talking about teacher funding, and this is something that not teacher funding, let me rephrase that, public school funding, overall funding, and the formulas on how that gets dispersed throughout the state. And so the Program Evaluation Committee, which, by the way, is a group that looks at state government, and, for example, you know, maybe they've got 15 cars and they only need 10, so they would do a study and say, hey, you guys only need 10. And they would recommend legislation that says we only need 10. I mean, it's really that simple. They are kind of like an auditor, kind of like a go-behind, a checker, as it were, to make sure the state government is running most efficiently and in the best way possible. Well, they looked at school funding and the formula that's currently being used, and they said, this doesn't seem maybe as equitable as it should. Perhaps some of the wealthier school districts are getting the lion's share of state appropriations. And so reached out to Representative Craig Horn, who's one of the chairs of the Program Evaluation Committee, and he's also a chairman of the House Appropriations Committee for Education, as well as the House Education Policy Committee. Those last two will meet during the session. Program evaluation typically meets during the interim period when they're not in session, like right now. So without further ado, I'm going to step aside and let you join in our conversation with Representative Craig Horn on what matters in North Carolina. It's always our pleasure to speak with folks from the North Carolina General Assembly, and today we're talking with Representative Craig Horn. He represents the fine folks in Union County, and Representative Horn, welcome to What Matters in North Carolina.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. I'm glad to be able to participate today.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about school funding today, but before I got into that, I just wanted to ask you to kind of give a thumbnail of your thoughts of the recent election. A lot of people thought that the North Carolina House Republican majority, or at least supermajority, was in jeopardy, that you guys might lose 8 or 9 seats, but lo and behold, you did pretty well.
I'd say we did pretty well. We have the same number of Republicans in the House this year as we did last year. The only change was we did have an unaffiliated person that caucused with the Republicans, and that seat has now, that seat, yes, is now not unaffiliated anymore. I believe that seat's a Democratic seat and would caucus with the Democrats. So the Republicans, in spite of all of these predictions of I don't know, disaster, whatever, I think the voters spoke loud and clear across the state that we are fundamentally a conservative state, and that I think the other message is that folks want they don't want business as usual. They want us to continue to make the kind of changes we've been making toward a more fiscally responsible state, and one that is more reflective of the personality of the state.
Yeah. Well, congratulations, I know, are in order. And a lot of people think, maybe incorrectly, that when you guys aren't in session, you're not really doing anything. But you had a big meeting last week.
We sure did. Quite a thunderbolt, if you ask me, from coming out of PED, which is Program Evaluation Division, sort of our internal inspector general, if you will. The purpose of PED is to look behind the curtain and answer a fundamental question. And that fundamental question is, what are we getting for what we're paying? And associated with that question is, are we operating in the most efficient and effective manner possible? Well, governments are not known for their efficiency in general. And here in North Carolina, we are the ninth largest state in the union, now more than 10 million people.
Wow.
With a $22 billion budget, there are a lot of things that need to be reviewed. The nature of our state has changed significantly, not just politically, but commercially over the last 20 years. And we haven't always made the appropriate changes in how we do business in order to properly reflect the nature of and the demands of this state.
Well, you happen to be one of the chairmen of the Program Evaluation Committee. And last week, you guys were looking at school funding, and I was reading about that, and I thought, well, you know what? I need to talk to Representative Horn about this, because this looks like something that you guys will probably be tackling in the long session, at least talking about anyway. I don't think it's something that you can make a quick decision on, but the report that the Program Evaluation Division came out with seemed to indicate that the way the public school funding system works right now, with 37 different categories, sometimes favors wealthier counties and in regard to teacher pay and that sort of thing. First of all, did you agree with the findings overall from the Program Evaluation folks?
In the broad view, yes, I did agree with them. I do agree with those findings. That's why I made the motion to refer this entire process to a joint special committee to do an even deeper dive into the recommendations, into the findings and the recommendations. I believe that we do need a fundamental change in how we fund education in this state. I believe in a student-centered funding process versus this ADM approach that's been used for quite a number of years.
What is that, Representative Horn?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but one more point is that there's been an ongoing series of discussions about how we fund charter schools. This report also deals with that issue. So perhaps we can ensure that we are fairly funding all of the students and all the schools in our state.
Now, I was going to ask you, what you said ABM system, what does that particularly mean?
ADM stands for Average Daily Maintenance, but what it really means is warm hind ends in a seat.
Okay.
It's attendance.
Okay. So for those of our listeners that aren't familiar with that, we can relate to warm hind ends in a seat. You guys, obviously education is a big chunk of the general fund budget. So for those of us that might not, you know, understand how this works, do you guys just, you know, write checks to Mecklenburg County and Pasquotank County and Wake County and Union County? Or how does that, what is the, simplistically, how does that money get allotted right now in terms of how the process works right now?
Well, right now, we base our funding on several factors. First, it's attendance, or what's ADM, average daily maintenance, attendance. Secondly, and to a great extent, we have quite a number of what's often referred to as silos. That is, there's money specifically earmarked for children with disabilities. There's
okay.
money specifically earmarked for English language learners. Where's money specifically allotted for low-wealth counties or rural counties. All of these various silos have been complicated by politics, by changes in demographics, by lots of things over the last 20 years. So I believe, and apparently PED researchers believe, that it's time for us to review how we allocate all those funds.
And one of the things that was mentioned out of this meeting was a kind of a weighted funding model. Now,
right.
that sounds like it would be different than what's going on now. Again, this stuff is kind of complex, and I don't expect everyone to understand right out of the gate what we're talking about. But compared to what we have right now, what would a weighted funding model look like?
Well, it'd be much more simple in application, and I think much more simple in for all of us to understand. By, as I said just a minute ago, right now we have all these different silos, but a weighted funding model fundamentally takes accounts for a child attending a school and then gives extra weight if that child has a disability or other things. So it's a much simpler method of allocating and much simpler method to understand.
Okay. And would people, you know, moms and dads dropping their kids off at the school bus Monday through Friday, would they tend to notice changes like this, Representative Horn, or is this something that would be more of a behind-the-scenes thing that people would not really see day to day?
For the most part, people are not going to see a significant change. Now, however, for children, let's use children with disabilities as an example.
Okay.
We cap our children with disabilities funding. The proposed weighted student formula would not cap it. It would fund kids that needed to be funded. And I'm saying kids with disabilities. The rather than just here's an amount of money, spread it out as you see fit. This would be more oriented to the individual needs of every student in the state. So some LEAs, local education agencies, school systems, if you will see changes in how the funding comes to them, primarily in the amount of money, as well as some changes in how they will be allowed to apply the money.
And how do you think, I know that, I believe if I'm reading correctly, this was something that you were quoted as saying, this is a huge deal. These are people's lives we're dealing with. Something that you feel like needs to be looked at, but cautiously. So you've recommended that a study committee, is that what you said, would be formed to look at this?
We're going to, the proposal, which will come back before PED in the coming next month in our December meeting, the proposal would create a joint legislative task force to look more deeply into the PED report and come up with propose legislation to the General Assembly in order to implement a student-based funding model instead of an attendance-based funding model.
So this joint legislative task force, is this something that could meet during the session?
It could. By the time we get it created, we allocate funds for it, assign staff. It's likely that this task force won't actually get to its work until after the long session.
So then after that, in the interim between the long and the short, is when you would really have an opportunity to dig down into the details of something like this.
Correct.
So your first thoughts is, I guess, obviously you feel like it's something worth looking at anyway. Do you think this would be something highly contentious?
Any change is contentious, Mark. Every time somebody proposes a new idea, a new way of tackling a particular problem, there are those people that will immediately go on defense because they'll see it as an attack on the status quo. And that's not the intention here at all. We're not attacking anyone or anything. What we're trying to do is modernize and our funding approach, provide some efficiencies, but mostly try to be more responsive to the needs of the individual student all over the state, regardless of where they're in school or what school it is they're attending.
Well, I don't think anybody at the end of the day, Representative Horn, should be arguing with that, particularly, as you said, this is something that is the focus is on the student. One last question for you in regard to all of this. We have heard throughout the years that some of the rural counties and lower wealth counties just don't seem to be able to help themselves because they don't have the infrastructure, they don't have the tax base to do things with their schools and improvements and all this kind of stuff. Would this funding model change possibly help some of those types of school districts that one would call lower wealth, for lack of a better word?
I think it would. I think, again, it's going to be reflective of the needs of the student rather than the needs of the LEA or the county. Mm-hmm. And that's the proper way to fund education. We are required by Constitution to provide, and by court dictate, to provide a sound basic education to every child in this state. It could be argued that, as you said in the very beginning of our interview, that the more wealthy counties are getting more funding, really turns out to be per student funding, than are some of the poor counties, because the poor counties just don't have the wherewithal. Mm-hmm. So we're back where we started here in a fundamental change in how we allocate funds, and those funds will be allocated on the needs of each and every student.
Well, it sounds exciting to me anyway. I think this is work that I know from having worked around you down there for 4 years. I know that you take this stuff seriously and that you will do everything that you can to, as you say, make sure that the students are at the top of the list when it comes to prioritizing funding here in North Carolina. Representative Horn, thank you very much for being our guest and for explaining this to us, and we'll look forward to seeing how it all unfolds.
Buckle your seatbelt. It's going to be an exciting ride, but a worthwhile one.
All right. Well, thank you very much, sir. We appreciate you being our guest.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, I've known Representative Horn for quite some time, pretty much a straight shooter, and doesn't mind speaking his mind. And so a lot of those guys at the General Assembly are like that, and I think that's pretty cool. A lot of times you get politicians and, you know, they'll tell you what you want to hear and this and that, but Representative Horn is pretty much a straight shooter, and so we appreciate about that about him, and we appreciate him being on What Matters in North Carolina. It's really neat the way the folks in the General Assembly are more than happy to come on this show, and I think it speaks to the quality of the show and the content that we're bringing and the fact that we treat our guests with respect and give them an opportunity to speak what's on their mind. And so fast becoming, I think, probably the most, well, the best talk show in the state as far as policy and politics go. Of course, I am a little biased, but nevertheless. So I guess you heard last week Forbes ranked North Carolina number 2 in its list of best states for business in spite of House Bill 2. You know, let's just talk about that for a moment. If you listen to people on the left, they just, their heads explode, and they want you to think that everything in North Carolina is falling apart, that teachers are leaving in droves, that businesses are leaving in droves, and yet here, in an objective evaluation by certainly one of the most well-respected business magazines in the world, Forbes, they rank number 2, North Carolina, best states for business. Oh, my goodness. Are you kidding me? How can that be? That mean old General Assembly with all them mean old Republicans won't let anybody go to the bathroom in North Carolina. Well, folks, I think we learned our lesson in this election. Have you seen all of the fake news stories and stories about fake news? You know, your social media feed and mine was filled with just utter nonsense leading up to the election. And I mentioned this yesterday to Representative Hardister that there's growing distrust of the media among the American people. And so instead of looking at themselves and what do they call it down south, having a come to Jesus meeting, that means where you kind of reevaluate and figure out maybe I ought to do something a little differently. No, the media is not going to do that. They're going to keep pounding their left-wing drum and presenting stories in such a way that it's going to continue to foster distrust among the American people. And so, you know, let them keep doing that. Because you know what? It didn't work. As much as they tried to tell you and me that Donald Trump had no chance, that Hillary was ahead by 800 points in the polls, it didn't work. It did not work. And this reminds me of when Senator Tillis was running against Kay Hagan. Remember those commercials? You saw like 17 of them every night on every channel. Tom Tillis has cut education in North Carolina by $500 million. Every single night. I got so tired of those commercials. And, you know, I worked in the Senate. I saw the budget. I knew it wasn't true. And I'm screaming at the TV, how can they just run this bilge, this blatant nonsense, this totally factless commercials? Well, guess what? After Tillis won, I think I've mentioned this before, but it bears repeating. I looked at a poll from a firm that did a poll of people who voted in the Tillis-Hagan race, and undecideds went online and looked for themselves, and they found that these commercials were blatant lies, and it offended them, and they voted for Tillis. Now, I'm sure that's not the only reason he won, but it was significant. And folks, I'm telling you, the media had better learn that, maybe we ought to start telling the truth at least sometime. I mean, here's a tweet Before Civitas even had their press conference today about the same-day voter registration, Civitas seeks to throw out all same-day registration votes. That's not true. But yet somebody in the local media here decided that that's what they needed to post. I mean, really? Why? Why would you do that? Oh, agenda much? Well, anyway, along those same lines, ESPN is finding that people are not watching as much, and Disney is being affected. You know, Disney owns ESPN, and there was a headline, ESPN continues to plague Disney as revenue misses. Have you ever noticed if you turn on ESPN on television or any of the local sports talk radio that is ESPN affiliates, they're all just as liberal as the day is long, and they here locally, they like to make fun of Governor McCrory, and they just ran about HB2. And guess what? It's affecting revenue from the parent company, Disney. And so, for example, Curt Schilling, you know what? Baseball hero with the bloody sock. He supported women's privacy and safety in public bathrooms, talking about HB2, and ESPN fired him. ESPN gives Caitlyn Jenner their annual Courage Award instead of a double amputee veteran of Iraq. You know, and then they threw more. I'm reading from a Family Research Council article here. ESPN threw more fuel on the fire when it gave platform to Black Lives Matter at its ESPY Awards and supported NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick's hugely unpopular decision to sit out during the national anthem. So, what's happening here? ESPN is all about tolerance. No, they're not. They don't tolerate people that don't feel the same way they do. You see, it's all about tolerating the liberal agenda, not anything else. And you know what? It's hurting Disney's bottom line, and I, for one, think that's okay. Well, we've got another great interview coming up. I'm going to totally shift gears and probably get some people's attention because we're going to talk about commercial fishing. You may or may not know, but there's a big battle brewing on the coast between commercial fishermen and recreational fishermen. And, well, let me get out of the way. We're going to talk to Jerry Schill. He's intimately involved, and he is, of course, the president of the North Carolina Fisheries Association, and he'll be giving their side in response to some proposed new regulations on shrimp trawling. So enjoy our talk with Jerry Schill now on What Matters in North Carolina. Joining us now, it's Jerry Schill. He is president of the North Carolina Fisheries Association, and we're going to be talking about a hot topic down at the coast. Jerry, welcome to What Matters in North Carolina.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. It's good to be here.
Well, I first got involved with this issue, the ongoing battle, it seems, between commercial fishermen and those who would regulate, over-regulate, and recreational fishermen, back when I worked in the Senate for Senator Tillman, and I know you know Senator Tillman, and he has a great deal of respect for what you guys do. But what caught my eye was a report, or recommendation, I guess, from the wildlife folks that additional shrimp trawling rules, regulations, whatever you want to call them, be put in place. And you feel like that's something that would not be very beneficial to your livelihood. So why don't you give us an overview of what these regulations are trying to say?
Sure, I'd be glad to. You know, I've been doing this for 29 years, started in 1987. And the one issue that without a doubt that has taken up most of the time since I've been involved in representing the state's commercial fishermen has been the reduction of bycatch in the shrimp trawl fishery. So shrimp trawling has been going on in this state for decades and decades. And what I'm about to say doesn't mean that shouldn't be regulated. When you're talking about environmental issues, it's very important to take care of what you have, including water quality and habitat and all that. So the one issue that we've spent a lot of time on over the years and it is reducing bycatch in the shrimp trawl fishery. But it's also been the most productive. In other words, the time that we've spent, invested in reducing bycatch came about as a result of a cooperative effort and a collaborative effort between private business, that is the shrimpers, and the government. When the government, and associated with this, Mark, is the protection of sea turtles, because we have, sea turtles are also a form of bycatch in the shrimp fishery. So in the late 1980s, we were charged with protecting sea turtles and come up with turtle excluder devices, and the government came up with some suggested devices that did not work for various reasons. They were too cumbersome. You know, the bureaucrats were not the people on the boat.
Right.
So the way they come up with a system that worked to reduce sea turtles being caught in a shrimp net is when the fishermen got involved in collaboration with the bureaucrats and Sea Grant and that sort of thing, and come up with a device that works to the point now where everybody uses them with very little reduction in shrimp catch, and we protect sea turtles. Well, then we started on reducing other finfish bycatch, and again, the state of North Carolina did not do what the feds did with the turtle stuff. What the state of North Carolina, through the Division of Marine Fisheries, did was automatically include private industry people, the shrimpers involved. And so we were the first state to mandate bycatch reduction devices in our shrimp trawls in the early 1990s. And the reason that's been so darn successful is, again, they come up with these with industry being involved, and we were the first state to mandate their inclusion in our shrimp nets. And ever since then, as a matter of fact, right now we're going through another study to reduce bycatch even further. So when we do all this work for almost 30 years, and then a so-called environmental group, this is the North Carolina Wildlife Federation,
right,
files a petition for rulemaking, and their legal counsel, by the way, is the Southern Environmental Law Center.
Okay.
SELC is doing the legal representation for the Wildlife Federation. So then here we are, kind of beating our chest because we've been successful in doing this, but we still try to do better. And then they file a petition for rulemaking that would devastate the shrimpers if the commission would adopt what they're recommending. And what they're recommending just isn't in inside waters. It's in the ocean out to 3 miles. That's where the state jurisdiction ends, in the ocean, is from 3 miles from shore. So this would devastate the shrimping industry in North Carolina, which is very, very important in our state. And just 3 years ago, there was an individual that filed a petition for rulemaking to do something very similar. And we had to go through all the time, in which takes money, to deal with that. And the commission found that it did not have merit at that time. So that's where we're at right now, and if it's okay, then I can expound on the right way to go about this.
Well, let's just, for our listeners, bycatch means fish that are caught up in a shrimp trawling net, fin fish like croaker and spot and stuff like that. That's what you're talking about.
Yes, and just to clarify, and that's a good point, Mark, just to clarify, bycatch does not mean it's wasted. If you're targeting shrimp and you catch a croaker that's marketable and you can sell it, you don't throw it away, but it's still called bycatch. If it's thrown overboard, in other words, if they're juvenile fish that don't have any marketable value, then those are called discards. So bycatch is a broad term that includes everything. If you catch anything that's not a shrimp, it's called bycatch. In the same way, you know, if you have a a yard that has centipede grass but has Bermuda grass growing somewhere. Bermuda grass, in that case, is a weed. Bermuda grass is, you know, nice stuff in its place, but not out of place. And in the same way, bycatch is anything that's not targeted.
So in terms of these new regulations, I'm looking at an article here, and it looks like that the regulations would affect shrimp trawlers operating in coastal sounds. It would reduce the size of nets, limit how long nets could be pulled in the water, shrimping only 3 days a week, and eliminate nighttime shrimping. Now, you're saying the regulation actually goes all the way out to the, it's not just in the sounds, but it's all the way out to the 3 mile state border.
Yeah, that's what they're proposing to do. You know, it's limiting the size of the shrimp. That's what, you know, when I made my public comments last Thursday at the Marine Fisheries Commission meeting in Kitty Hawk, I called a spade. And that's one thing I learned in this industry. You just tell it like it is and let the chips fall. And what I said was, let's not kid ourselves. This is not really meant to be a limit on shrimping. This is meant to be a ban on shrimping and eventually a ban on all nets. That's a battle that our fishermen have been facing since the mid-90s.
Well, so in terms of what's hard to understand, Jerry, and our guest is Jerry Schill, and he is of course, the president of the North Carolina Fisheries Association, speaking on behalf of commercial fishermen. Jerry, what's hard to understand is, where do you find the truth? Because I remember back in 2011, House Bill 353, where they were trying to designate red drum, spotted sea trout, and striped bass as game fish, sort of drew a lot of attention. And some people would say that the stock of these fish was really low, that the gill nets were hurting the ability to restock and replenish the fish in their habitat. Commercial fishermen on the other side say that this is not true, that there's plenty of, you know, stock. So where do we really find the truth? I mean, I know you can't go into water and count every fish, but how is there such a divide on, you know, what the commercial fishermen would say as opposed to what folks like the Southern Environmental Law Center would say?
Well, you know, our view has always been about the science. You can't regulate fisheries based on rhetoric, and I spew my share of it as well. But you know, when you look at what this is, we're talking about a public trust resource market. That means it belongs to all of us. There's less than 10% of the citizens of our state fish in any way, shape, or form in saltwater. If you add up all the recreational fishermen in saltwater and all the commercial fishermen that commercially fish in saltwater, it's way, way less than 10%. Yet those resources belong to everybody. I don't fish. That may shock a lot of people, but I have never held a commercial fishing license. I've never commercially fished, and I really don't care to recreationally fish. For the same reason, by the way, I don't like to golf. I grew up on a farm, and I like to work. It's something. But I don't like to recreationally fish, but I love to eat seafood. I'm a consumer.
Right.
I'm an owner of that resource. And over 90% of the people that own that resource don't fish for it. So how do you get it? I think that I, as a consumer, have a right to have access to that seafood. And therein lies the rub right now when you get into these battles. But to get to the crux of your question, which is, who do you believe? You got to go by the science. And when you look at the petition that was filed, for example, by the North Carolina Wildlife Federation to limit shrimp trawling, there are two individuals that provided technical information to back up their petition, One of them is the former director at the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries, and one of them is the former director at the Virginia Marine Resources Commission. Well, you know, they're no longer in those positions, and they're both employed by organizations that are wanting to limit commercial fishing or the public's access to that resource. When you look at the science, when you look just because a scientist says it doesn't make it so. In this petition, the former director in North Carolina made some comments that are in direct conflict with what he said 3 years ago when a similar petition was filed. So to say that you've got to get your information from a scientist, that in itself doesn't do it. Fisheries is very, very confusing, even if you've been involved with it for a long time, and also very contentious. And for the average person to try to make a sound decision based on what they read in the paper is very, very difficult.
Well, we found that out during the elections. The papers aren't very reliable.
Indeed.
So there are people, though, that are very, very adamant, Jerry. Gill nets are destroying the habitat, and you know, they need to quit fishing with gill nets in the sounds and all this kind of stuff. So how do you answer that?
Well, you know, we've had study after study after study. And like anything, everything has a semblance of truth to it. Gill nets can be destructive if not fished properly. Gill nets can also be very selective. It takes somebody that knows what they're doing. If a fisherman goes out with a gill net and he makes his living by fishing, the last thing he wants to do is to catch fish that is not targeted. In other words, if he wants to go out and target a particular species of fish, he doesn't need to be spending half his time pulling small fish out of the net, which is the reason why he selects a certain type, size and type of net to eliminate that bycatch. But, you know, gill nets have been used for a long time, so have shrimp trawls, and all this information and this rhetoric, you know, we have people now on the Marine Fisheries Commission and legislators that are making these decisions, and our job is to try to make sure that they get the right information.
Well, we appreciate you coming on. I think that we're going to do several of these interviews. Unfortunately, our time is running a little bit long here, but let me ask you this. Where does all this stand right now, and who makes these final decisions? Will it be the legislature? Will it be the Department of Marine Fisheries? Will it be the Wildlife Federation? Who ultimately will be responsible for whether or not these new shrimp trawling regulations go into place?
Well, as far as the most recent petition, which is what we're talking about, that's the Marine Fisheries Commission's charge. And there are nine members of the Marine Fisheries Commission. They're all appointed by the governor, and they make that decision. So the ultimate decision will be made by them. At this point in time, it looks like they'll make that decision at their February meeting in Wilmington. But in addition, the Marine Fisheries Commission exists, and the governor makes those appointments because the General Assembly says that's what they shall do. In other words, the General Assembly is the one that writes the enabling legislation that puts the Marine Fisheries Commission into existence, and then the governor, as the chief executive of the state, actually makes those appointments. So,
well,
I guess you could say it's somewhat political, Mark.
Here's an interesting question. We're in the middle of a big, you know, mess with the Cooper-McCrory results. Put you on the spot. Would it be better for you if McCrory wins or if Cooper wins?
Well, like I said, I'm very frank, and this is very personal. We don't endorse candidates as an organization. I personally voted for Governor McCrory because I voted early. Had I voted on election day, I would have left it blank. Mr. Cooper came out with a position on marine fisheries on his website, and it was not kind to commercial fishermen. So that's one thing. Plus, I'm very involved in some social issues, too, that I feel very strongly about. but and Governor McCrory is right on those issues from my personal perspective. But when he, the 8 days before the election, made some appointments to the Marine Fisheries Commission that, in my view, were, well, they were very anti-commercial fishing in the way they were made, and in my personal opinion, they were done because of contributions to the campaign. To me, that's a moral issue, and I had severe problems with the way that was done. So there I am, going out on the record, making a no-win situation, but one of the things I love about our state is our motto, to be rather than to seem. You know, we've always tried to be upfront with everybody and let them know where we stand, and in answering your question, that's just more of that same attitude.
Okay. Well, Jerry, we're going to leave it right there. I can believe pretty strongly that we'll be back in touch with you again soon, because this is not an issue that's going to go away. You're an excellent spokesperson for the commercial fishermen, and we know that there are a lot of them in North Carolina, and that's how they make their living. So these kinds of you know, regulations and stuff that government tries to add to you guys certainly doesn't help your situation. So thank you very much for being our guest on What Matters in North Carolina.
Well, thank you, Mark. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, Jerry Shill joining us here on What Matters in North Carolina. Plain-spoken guy, and he doesn't fish. How about that? Doesn't like to play golf either, he said. But anyway, appreciate him coming on the show and talking about these regulations from the North Carolina Wildlife Federation. And it kind of, you know, no surprise, the Southern Environmental Law Center behind these additional regulations. I haven't really formed an opinion yet on this whole battle. We're going to talk to someone on the other side, possibly for tomorrow's show, someone talking about recreational fishermen and how they feel about what they say is, you know, commercial fishermen killing the stock of fish and other, you know, shrimp and stuff like that off the coast of North Carolina. So we'll get another side, and hopefully we'll be able to understand a little bit more about what's going on. But you're talking about people, Jerry Shill said, you know, they are trying to basically do away with our way of living. And I guess that's why they're fired up. I mean, wouldn't you be? I certainly would be. And so we appreciate him coming on the show today. So there you go, folks. We have hit everything for you today that's going on. Commercial fishermen, and we've talked about public school funding formulas, and also Francis DeLuca of the Civitas Institute talking about the action that they filed with the State Board of Elections and a lawsuit in federal court dealing with same-day registration. And again, if you didn't hear the interview, go back to the beginning of the podcast and listen. It's not about throwing out every single same-day registration vote, as a local media person erroneously reported on Twitter. It's about making sure that those registrations are verified, just like everyone else's had to be verified who did not register during early voting and was able to take advantage of same-day registration. Makes perfect sense to me, really. I mean, this is one of the more simple things that you can look at and say, well, yeah, that makes sense. We will find out soon enough, I guess, whether or not Governor McCrory will catch Roy Cooper in his bid to return to Raleigh as the governor. Kind of rude, Roy Cooper already putting together a transition team and the voting, canvassing, and counting hasn't even been completed. But I guess he's pretty confident. And a lot of people on the left saying that the GOP is trying to steal the election and all of this kind of stuff. And, God, you know, for people that are so into fairness and doing what's right, they won't even let the votes be counted. Kind of makes you scratch your head. Anyway, thank you for listening to What Matters in North Carolina. We will have another great show for you tomorrow, and then we'll be celebrating the Thanksgiving holiday, and hope that you will be too with your families. Thanks for listening. Bye.